right. Theologians and Bible scholars, they like to classify God's attributes into two different categories. There are his communicable and his incommunicable attributes. I know that sounds really fancy. Don't worry, the rest of the sermon is not going to be confusing or anything, but I do need to explain these sort of briefly. God's incommunicable attributes, that simply means those attributes or qualities of God that were not communicated to us at creation when he created us. His incommunicable attributes, those not communicated to us, would be his immutability, the fact that he never changes, his sovereignty, which refers to his power and his control over all of creation, his omniscience, which just refers to the fact that God knows everything, his omnipresence, which refers to the reality that God is everywhere all at the same time. Those are his incommunicable attributes. His communicable attributes, which means those that were communicated to us when he created us, this is what Genesis 1, 26 and 27 is referring to when it says that we were created in his image. It refers to God's freedom. We're given some of that quality. We have freedom. We're free moral agents. We can make decisions and so forth. His mercy, we have the ability, like God does, to show mercy to people, to show mercy. And his beauty, as God is beautiful, so too is there some of that beauty that's communicated to each of us. And another one of his communicable attributes is wisdom. And some of that is imparted to us. This morning, I'd like to focus explicitly on wisdom, that attribute. God himself is wise, and he's imparted some of that wisdom to us. And it's important for us to know what that wisdom from God is and what that wisdom is not. And so since I like to do most of the talking, I don't usually read a lot of stuff because it cuts into my sermon at the time. But I do think this is so important, I'd actually like us to read through it together and talk about what wisdom is and what wisdom is not. One of my favorite Christian books was written by J.I. Packer. It's called Knowing God. There's numerous parts of it that I've read repeatedly. And this is an excerpt from it. If you look at the bottom, I've got the information about the book. It's on pages 102 and 103 when Packer discusses the wisdom of God. When I read this the first time, it changed my understanding and confidence about God's sovereignty and the way that he works, and you might say the way that he doesn't work in our lives. And so at the beginning, this is what wisdom is not, but what commonly people think wisdom is. He says, if you were taken to the signal box atop the largest train station in the world, on the wall, you'll see a diagram of the entire track layout for miles on every side of the station with little lights moving or stationary on the different tracks showing the signalman where every engine and train is. At once, you'll be able to look at the whole situation through the eyes of the one who controls it. You'll see why this train had to halt, that one diverted from its normal running line, and that one parked temporarily on the side. The reasons for all these movements become plain once you can see the overall position and plan. The mistake that is commonly made is supposing that this is an illustration of what God does when he bestows wisdom. That wisdom from God provides a deeper insight into the providential meaning and purpose of events going on around us, an ability to see why God has done what he has done in a particular case and what he is going to do next. People feel that if they were really walking closely with God so that he could impart wisdom to them freely, then they would find themselves in the signal box discerning the real purpose of everything that happened to them. And it would be clear every moment how God was making all things work together for good. People who believe this spend much time poring over God's providence, wondering why God allowed this or that to take place, whether they should take it as a sign to stop doing one thing and start doing another. If they end up confused, they put it down to their own lack of spirituality, leading to depression and driving them crazy with this kind of futile inquiry. On occasion, he will confirm his will to us, but this is different than reading a message behind everything that happens to us. So that's what wisdom is not. Wisdom is not being up in the signal box to understand every single thing that transpires in the world and why it happened, and why this happened to this person, and why this didn't happen to that person, why this happened in our lives. Now, what wisdom is, this bottom paragraph, it's like being taught to drive, where what matters is the speed and appropriateness of your reactions to things and the soundness of your judgment at the situations encountered. You don't ask why the road narrows or twists where it does, or why that van is parked where it is, or why the driver in front hugs the road so tightly. You simply see and do the right thing in the actual situations that present themselves. Wisdom from God enables us to do just that in the actual occurrences of everyday life. Now, there's a certain wisdom that comes from a deep relationship with God. There's a certain wisdom that comes from walking with and knowing God that's exemplified and manifested in the lives of believers. It's the sort of wisdom that we see in the lives of great men like Joseph and Daniel, who can encounter different situations in their lives and always seem to know the right thing to do. Now, you've probably heard the quote that that darkness is the absence of light. If we sort of apply that and we think that darkness is the absence of light, then I want to go a little further and say that foolishness is the absence of wisdom. Foolishness is the absence of wisdom. You might be wondering why I'm talking about all this. The reason is that this week, as I was studying the rest of 1 Samuel 14, I couldn't help thinking the entire time that Saul's life was characterized by foolishness. That the behaviors and the actions, the decisions that he makes through the rest of this chapter literally just look foolish from beginning to end. In a sense, if men like Joseph and Daniel exemplified wisdom, then to me, Saul exemplifies foolishness. And this morning, I'd like to talk a little bit about why he looked so foolish and hopefully learn from his life so that we can make sure we don't look the same. Now, in 1 Samuel 14, we're going to be starting at verse 24 in the middle of the chapter. So let's review just a little bit. This is essentially a story that started back in chapter 13. Here's what transpired. Jonathan stepped out and attacked the Philistines because God didn't want his people, the Israelites, in subjection to another nation. It was God's plan that they were going to be the preeminent and the predominant nation on the earth. The Israelites were subject to the Philistines. Jonathan, recognizing the problems associated with that, stepped out in faith, and he attacked the Philistines. Saul, really foolishly, tried to take credit for Jonathan's initiative. He offered up the sacrifice that Samuel was supposed to offer up in chapter 13, and because of that, the Israelites weren't able to completely destroy the Philistines. When chapter 14 started, with the Israelites essentially outnumbered and outmatched in every way, Jonathan, a tremendous man of faith, one of my heroes of the Old Testament, at this really significant and dramatic time, stepped out and took on an entire garrison or detachment of Philistines with only his armor bearer. God sent an earthquake that sent all of the Philistines into disarray and confusion. And then at that really, really crucial time, when it was Saul's job or responsibility as the leader over the rest of the army to finish the battle that Jonathan had initiated, Saul really foolishly didn't attack at the right time. And that's basically where we finished last week. He should have attacked, but he started to take roll to find out who had left. And when this chapter starts, he does something even more foolish than last week. If you look in verse 24 at this really crucial, dramatic moment when the Israelites can completely destroy and wipe out the Philistines, Saul does something that's unimaginable. In verse 24 it says, "Now the men of Israel were in distress that day, because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, 'Cursed be any man who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies.' So none of the troops tasted food." This has a sort of appearance of spirituality, but the reality is that it's just ridiculously foolish. Back in chapter 14, when Saul should have attacked, he called for the ark to consult with God and didn't attack. It had the appearance of being spiritual. Let me slide my mic down. Are you guys hearing me? Let's see if this makes any better. I think it's me breathing into it a little bit. We'll see if that stops it. So Saul should have attacked last chapter. He called for the ark and didn't attack. So he did something that looked spiritual but was foolish, and here he kind of does the exact same thing. He does something that looks spiritual by calling for this fast, when in reality it's just foolish. There's enemies that need to be finished off, and if you think about it, the one thing that these men probably need more than anything else at this time is their strength and their energy to be able to pursue these Philistines and wipe them out. If you look in the verse, as a result of Saul's vow or his oath, it says that the men were in distress, and so Saul didn't provide the leadership that would have given the men the physical sustenance and energy that they needed for this battle. In addition to being really foolish, the vow is also very selfish. If you look at Saul's words, he wasn't concerned about defending the nation of Israel. He wasn't concerned about defending God's honor and bringing him glory and praise. He wasn't concerned about trying to destroy God's enemies or Israel's enemies. The entire vow from beginning to end is exclusively about Saul. He says, "Before I have avenged myself on my enemies." He told the people that they couldn't eat until the people that he hated were taken out of the picture. I want to talk really briefly about oaths, because I'll be remiss if we go past this without discussing them, except for the Nazarite vow, or the Nazarite oath, which was established by God. Almost every single other oath we see in the Bible that's taken by man was foolish and had terrible consequences. In Joshua 9, if you remember, Israel took an oath to protect the Gibeonites. That ended up being problematic because the Gibeonites were disguising themselves. They were actually Canaanites. And just think about this. The Gibeonites fooled the Israelites into thinking they're people they weren't. Israel made a vow to protect the Gibeonites when in fact the Gibeonites were people that Israel was supposed to wipe out. And then the vow that they had taken prevented them from doing that. In Judges chapter 11, probably the most famous and foolish vow in the entire world, a man named Jephthah promised God that if God would give him victory over his enemy, the Ammonites, then Jephthah would sacrifice the very first thing that came out of his house. What came out of his house? His daughter. I don't know what he thought was going to come out of his house. I wonder about this. I don't know if he had like some pets or something, and he thought that might black out, and that would be kind of like the Reuben's dog that they hate, a joyful sacrifice. Not that Reuben's a sacrificing animal, but you know what I mean. Anyway, Judges chapter 21. In Judges 21, the nation of Israel, they took an oath. They were furious with the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin was one of the 12 tribes. Furious with them because of their sin in hiding some men who had committed terrible wickedness. Israel said, "We will not let any of our daughters be married to any of the men of Benjamin." Now, if the men of Benjamin can't marry any Israelite women, they're going to be forced to marry pagan women, or women outside the nation of Israel. So it's a foolish vow that they made when they were really angry and emotional. One of the low points in David's life that we'll reach, in 1 Samuel 25, he was angry with this guy named Nabal, because Nabal shaved the beards of all of his men when his men had protected Nabal's flocks. And then David vowed that he was going to kill Nabal. It was only Nabal's wife Abigail that came out and then talked David out of it. And then in Mark chapter 6, Herod vowed to give his daughter Herodias, or his stepdaughter Herodias, anything she wanted. And then what was it that she asked for? John the Baptist had on a platter, exactly. So what does the rest of the Bible say about oaths? Ecclesiastes 5:2 says, "Don't be quick with your mouth. Don't be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God." In Matthew 5:33-37, Jesus said, "Again, you've heard that it has been said to the people long ago." So Jesus is saying, this is what used to be said long ago. "Do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you've made." And then Jesus says, "But," and this is a really important word here, because he's showing a contrast between the way things used to be and the way that Jesus wants things now. He says, "But I tell you, don't swear an oath at all. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one." In James 5:12, he says, "Above all, my brothers and sisters, do not swear. All you need to say is a simple yes or no, otherwise you'll be condemned." And so, for people with integrity, oaths shouldn't be needed to support what they're saying. It's almost as though you think about people who maybe don't have as much integrity, and then when they say something, recognizing that they lack the integrity to convince people of the truth or the validity of what they're saying, what they say then. I swear, I promise, because what they said didn't have the weight or didn't have the credibility to stand alone. And so they have to sort of supplement it with a promise or a swear or an oath. And so Jesus says, no, you should be people of such integrity that your yes is yes and your no is no, that when you say something, people can take it at face value. With all that in mind, here's a few closing points about oaths. It seems to be, in my estimation, that most of the time when oaths are made, they're made in moments of impulsiveness or when people are kind of emotional and they just say, I swear. Like when Peter was being confronted about not knowing Jesus, and he says, I swear, I don't know the man. He cursed me if we feel strongly enough about doing something, we should have the discipline in our Christian lives to do those things without having to make an oath to enforce obedience. And finally, if we do make an oath, though, Psalm 15:4 says, God honors those who keep their oaths, even to their own detriment. And so even if we do make an oath, God says we still have a responsibility, that he's even pleased with those people who keep oaths, even to their own detriment. And so don't make oaths, but if you do, we need to make sure that we observe them. Now back to 1 Samuel. Verse 25, the entire army entered the woods and there was honey on the ground. This refers to honeycombs that were on the ground. You remember Israel was called a land flowing with milk and honey. One commentator said that the mopping up operations pursuing the enemy involved an exhausting, unremitting journey over steep hills for hours on end. And so if you think, if there was one thing at this time, literally more than anything else that the nation of Israel needed, it was probably the energy that honey could have provided for them. Our bodies run on glucose. Our bodies take carbs, break them down into glucose, which we use for fuel. There wouldn't have been any better source of energy or anything that could have been better for them at this time than this honey. In fact, I don't think it's too much to say that literally this was probably provision from God. I don't think it's too much to say that this was literally probably provision from God to provide the nation of Israel with the strength and energy necessary to be able to wipe out the rest of the Philistines. But because of Saul's foolish oath, the men aren't going to be able to consume any of this honey. It's just going to stay on the ground while they literally start starving to death. Verse 26, when they went into the woods, they saw the honey oozing out, yet no one put his hand to his mouth because they feared Saul's oath. So the men were starving. You can imagine how strongly, how much they wanted to eat this honey. You know, it's funny, we were running around yesterday, we're playing airsoft at the Reardons. He had this big airsoft party for him, and he got to make it. I'll tell you the funniest thing that happened yesterday was I was standing next to Nathan Donald. This isn't really related to my message. Nathan Donald said, "Hey, you just shot me. You just shot me, Glenn." Glenn Zumstein just shot Nathan. And so you guys are like, why is he telling us this story? Aren't you supposed to shoot people when you play airsoft? Well, the thing was, Glenn shot Nathan, but Glenn was on Nathan's team. And so anyway, Glenn's kind of like a loose cannon. Is Glenn in here right now? No? Just make sure you tell him I told that story. Where is he at? Oh, there's Glenn. Okay, he told me if I made fun of him, he wasn't going to make my bulletins anymore for me. He makes the bulletins for the church. But I'll ask for his forgiveness later. So anyway, the whole point I'm telling you all that kind of is that yesterday we were running around through the woods at the Reardon's house. It's like literally like they kind of live in a jungle. It was exhausting. I just could not wait for lunch. And so it's funny because I was teaching this thing and I thought about it a little bit. You know, what it must have been like for these men running over all that rough terrain in Israel, trying to defeat all these enemies for hours on end. They're starving. And then they see this honey. They're exhausted. It looks delicious to them. And all of them are terrified to eat it because of Saul's really foolish oath. And it's tragic, the consequences that are going to happen because of that. Now, verse 27. Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with the oath. If you remember in chapter 13, Jonathan left on his own to attack the Philistines. Apparently, Saul made this oath after Jonathan had already left. So Jonathan didn't hear the oath. So he reached out the end of the staff that was in his hand, and he dipped it into the honeycomb. He reached his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. Or the NIV says that it could read, his strength was renewed. So it had the exact effect that you would expect. It gave him strength and energy to continue the battle. Verse 28, then one of the soldiers told him, your father bound the army under a strict oath, saying, cursed be any man who eats food today. That is why the men are faint. And so when it says they're faint there, in the original language, it gives the idea that they're exhausted physically. Verse 29, Jonathan said, my father has made trouble for the country. See how my eyes brightened when I tasted a little of this honey, or my strength was renewed. Verse 30, how much better it would have been if the men had eaten today some of the plunder they took from their enemies. So apparently there was some food that the enemy had too that the nation of Israel could have eaten. Would not the slaughter of the Philistines have been even greater? And so Jonathan wisely recognized Saul's foolish oath prevented them from having the victory over the Philistines that they could have had. But I want to point something out here. As great as Jonathan is, I said before, he's one of my heroes from the Old Testament. He was wrong here. He messed up. He shouldn't have talked about his dad like that. This is a mistake. Even though everything that he said was right and true, he shouldn't have criticized his dad like this in front of his men. I remember this one time when I was in the military, or actually I was in ROTC, I was in college, I wasn't in the military yet. And I was in a supporting position, so there was another cadet who was in charge, and I was expected to do what he said. And part of his plan, I don't remember it exactly, part of his plan involved putting other cadets in the line of fire of other cadets. And so you don't ever want to be in the line of fire, like where you're pointing your M16, you know, ahead of you. You don't ever want to have people in front of you. And so he had this plan. I don't remember exactly what it looked like, but it involved putting men in front of other men like that. And we went back to this debriefing. There was about 50 of us there. And I remember saying how poorly I thought this was planned. I talked really, really critically about this guy. It was ugly. It was a terrible mistake on my part. And Colonel Brewer stood up, and he said to everyone, "I don't care who's over you. I don't care who your leader is." He said, "I don't care if he's the most pathetic leader that you've ever seen in your life. You need to submit to him and you need to support him." And he was an officer in the Army. He was not a Christian. He was speaking secularly. But he said, "If your CO, if your platoon leader, your CO is the worst CO that you've ever imagined, you still have a responsibility to submit to him and to support to him or respect him." And so I never forgot that. And I know that when he said that to those 50 cadets standing there, all their eyes went right to me. Because everybody knew that he was saying this because of me, because I sat there and ripped on this guy who had been in charge. And I'll never forget it. There was something significant that I took in the Christian life when I read Romans and Hebrews about submitting to the authority that's over us. And most of us in this room probably feel like there's leadership or there's authority that's over us that we don't like, whether it's in the government or maybe it's in our workplaces. But the reality is we all have a responsibility to submit and to support to that, or support that leadership that's over us. And that's an area where Jonathan failed right here in talking badly about his dad. Verse 31, "That day, after the Israelites had struck down the Philistines, from Michmash to Aijalon," so the Israelites had this victory, they defeated the Philistines from one place to another, basically, and it says they were exhausted. Verse 32, "They pounced on the plunder," because Saul said they could eat after they defeated the Philistines. They defeated them, they pounced on the plunder, and taking sheep, cattle, and calves, they butchered them on the ground, and they ate them together with the blood. So more than likely, the men were so starving that they had done whatever they could to just rip these animals open and eat them raw. That's how hungry they were. Now, Leviticus 17, 10 to 14, and Deuteronomy 12, 23 to 25, both state that the life of animals is in the blood, or the life of all creation is in the blood. Now, because all life belongs to God, this is why God commanded that we wouldn't consume blood. We wouldn't consume animals with the blood in it. He forbid it, because to consume the animals with the blood in it was to consume part of the life that was supposed to belong to God. And so here they sinned. They sinned against the Mosaic covenant. The men knew this. In verse 33, it says, "Then someone said to Saul, 'Look, the men are sinning against the Lord by eating meat that has blood in it.'" And then look at Saul's response here. You have broken faith, he said. "Roll a large stone over here at once." And so, as always, this is another instance of Saul's foolishness in this chapter. As always, Saul can never be wrong. He can never take responsibility for mistakes. And so he blames the people, even though there's a great sense in which the men did this because they were starving because of his foolish oath. And Jesus talked about this. He talks about us behaving in a manner that could lead other people to sin. In Matthew 18, 7, Jesus said, "Offenses will come, but woe to the person through whom they come." And in a sense, Saul fulfilled that. He didn't actually make the men do this, but he put them in a situation to commit this sin. In verse 34, then he said, this is still Saul speaking, then he said, go out among the men and tell them, "Each of you bring me your cattle and sheep and slaughter them here and eat them. Do not sin against the Lord by eating meat with blood still in it." So everyone brought his ox that night and slaughtered it there. Verse 35, then Saul built an altar to the Lord. I want you to notice this for a little later. It says it was the first time that he had done this. And there's a reason that the Bible points this out. There's a reason that the Bible reveals right here that this was the first time that Saul had ever built an altar. Just think about that for a second. What does that tell you about Saul? What does it tell you about his spiritual condition? Leadership should always represent the leadership set the example. The maturity should be evident in the lives of leadership. And Saul here is the leadership of the nation. He is the king. There's a sense in which he should have been the most spiritual man within the nation. And it probably wouldn't be too much to say that he was the most unspiritual man in the nation, or at least one of them. To think that his entire life, he had never constructed an altar to the Lord before this. Just remember that for the end of this message. Verse 36, Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them till dawn, and let us not leave one of them alive. Do whatever seems best to you," they replied. But the priest said, "Let us inquire of God here." So if you pause, what happened here was Saul decides to fight. He said, "Let's go down and attack the Philistines right now." In chapter 14, earlier, in verse 18, here's what happened. Saul was supposed to attack, but he decided to consult with God first. This time, he's supposed to consult with God first, but he tries to attack first. So he does the exact opposite of what took place earlier. And so he just looks foolish again. He looks like he doesn't know exactly what's supposed to happen. The reason I wanted you guys to read this, the reason that I mention this, if it hasn't been clear yet, just to be perfectly clear, is that wisdom from God, according to what Packer was said, or Packer was saying in his book, which I agree with and thought was phenomenal, is that essentially wisdom from God allows us to encounter the sort of twists and turns that life presents us and handle them and maneuver through them smoothly and with a certain ease that isn't evident within the lives of people who don't know God. He compared it to the analogy of driving, in that we're going to encounter these different twists and turns, and that the person who knows God and has a deep relationship with Him will have the maturity and the wisdom from the Lord to handle these turns and not get like in an accident, you might say. What I see in this chapter with Saul is like he just can't seem to maneuver the twists and turns of life right. When he's supposed to attack, he consults with God and doesn't attack. When he's supposed to consult with God, he doesn't, he attacks. He tries to be spiritual, and he calls for an oath, and he does it at the wrong time, and his men need food. And it's going to continue and get even worse. But just kind of keep this in mind as we go through this, that what Saul is exhibiting is the kind of foolishness that for the most part can be characterized in the life of any person who doesn't walk closely and intimately with the Lord. And so right here, verse 37, Saul asked God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into Israel's hand?" But God didn't answer him that day. Just keep that in mind too. So God wouldn't answer Saul. It didn't have anything to do with the fact that Jonathan had eaten the honey. It didn't have anything to do with the fact that these men had eaten this meat with the blood still in it. The real problem, the real reason that God wouldn't answer Saul here was because of Saul. So verse 38, "Saul therefore said, 'Come here, all you who are leaders of the army, and let us find out what sin has been committed today.'" So amazingly, Saul, as always, couldn't see the fault or the responsibility with himself. He thought that if there was something wrong, it must have been sin that was with others and not with him. So again, he looks foolish. Verse 39, "As surely as the Lord who rescues Israel lives, even if it lies with my son Jonathan." So Saul made this terribly foolish oath at the beginning of the chapter. He follows up his previous oath with this encore. His encore is to make another oath that he's going to kill his son if his son is wrong. And so in verse 39, he says, "As surely as the Lord who rescues Israel lives, even if the fault lies with my son, he must die." Just something to keep in mind for next week when we start chapter 15. In chapter 15, Saul was supposed to wipe out all the Amalekites, if you know the story. Do you remember Saul wasn't willing to kill Agag? He wasn't willing to kill Agag, the evil king of the Amalekites that God had commanded him to kill. So here's the irony. He won't kill an evil, wicked man that God commanded him to kill. Do you see the irony? In this chapter, he's willing to kill his own godly son who hadn't done anything wrong, who has been the hero throughout these last two chapters. Verse 39 continues and it says, "But none of the men said a word." All the men knew that Jonathan was the one who had eaten the honey, but they didn't want to give him up because of their respect and love and admiration for him. Verse 40, "Saul then said to the Israelites," he said, "'You stand over there. I and Jonathan, my son, will stand over here. Do what seems best to you,' the men replied." So here's what's happening. Saul's going to start using the Urim and Thummim. We talked about this last week. The Urim and Thummim were the sacred lots. They were like some implements that the nation of Israel used to determine God's will. And they're going to cast these, maybe they were like dice, cast these Urim and Thummim to determine where the fault is. And so Saul, assuming that the fault doesn't, he knows it doesn't lie with him, or expects it doesn't lie with him, assuming it's not with his son Jonathan, puts his son Jonathan here, and he takes the nation of Israel and puts them over there. But ironically, amazingly, the last thing that Saul could have expected is about to happen. Because when they do cast the lot to find out if the fault lies with Jonathan and Saul, or if it lies with the nation of Israel, look at verse 41. "Saul prayed to the Lord, the God of Israel, 'Give me the right answer.' And Jonathan and Saul were taken by lot, and the men were cleared. Verse 42, Saul said, cast the lot between me and Jonathan, my son, and Jonathan was taken. And this brings up a real question here. Why did God work through the Urim and Thummim? Why did God work through the sacred lot here to identify Jonathan as the one who had eaten the honey? The best answer I can come up with, the only thing that seems to make any sense, is I believe that God wanted to expose Saul to the foolishness of his oaths. I believe God wanted to expose Saul to the foolishness of his first and his second oath, in that when he saw that his son Jonathan was implicated in both of these oaths, he recognized the foolishness of his decisions in making these oaths in the first place and hopefully repent. That's the only way that this makes sense to me. The alternative is that God was helping Saul in a manner that was going to lead to the death of his son, which I don't really think could be possible. And so I think God set this up for Saul to see his foolishness, to repent from it. But amazingly, as we will see as this goes on, Saul will be willing to kill his own son. Verse 43, then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. So Jonathan told him, I merely tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now must I die? If you read in the King James, it doesn't capture it. It doesn't capture it perfectly. Because in the King James, it almost looks like Saul, like Jonathan is saying, now I must die. As though Jonathan was saying he knows he should die. But the original language implies that Jonathan was questioning, asking Saul, saying, do I really have to die for what I've done here? Now must I really die? So I don't think the King James has the question mark on the end there. Verse 44, unbelievably, Saul said, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan. And so, consider that Saul was willing to kill his very own son. He was willing to kill his son who had been the hero of this chapter, his son who had been the hero of the last chapter. And that's not the worst part. There's only one reason, and we all need to make sure that we see this, there's only one reason that Saul was willing to kill his son right now. Because the alternative was to admit that he had done something wrong. The alternative was to say, no, Jonathan, you shouldn't die because I was the one who was wrong in making this foolish oath. No, Jonathan, your life should be spared. You weren't really at fault. I was the one who was at fault for commanding something so foolish and stupid. But to save face, to make sure that he looks right and his son Jonathan looks wrong, he says, no, you have to die for what you've done. He just stands his ground and won't budge, you know, even an inch in confessing his foolishness. Verse 45, the men have been quiet up to this point. But the men said to Saul, should Jonathan die? He who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel, never, as surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground. For he did this today with God's help. So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. Earlier, the men wouldn't say anything. When they knew Jonathan had eaten, everyone was quiet to see Jonathan's life being spared. The moment that they think Jonathan's life is in jeopardy, all of them speak up because of their great admiration and respect for him. They save him and they say, no, Jonathan's not going to die. And they deliver him from his father here. Verse 46, then Saul, there's more foolishness. Then Saul stopped pursuing the Philistines and they withdrew to their own land. And so the Philistines, they were able to retreat to Philistia completely unhindered. You imagine that the initiative Jonathan had taken in attacking the Philistines, putting them in confusion and in disarray, the attack that God had blessed with the earthquake, that had the Philistines turning on each other and attacking each other, bringing the Philistines to this point of complete vulnerability where they could have been totally destroyed and removed because of their wickedness and because of Saul's foolishness and because of his pride. The Philistines were able to escape completely unhindered and safe back to their nation. Now, here's something really ironic. Let me share this with you. You never want to let your enemies get away. When you have the opportunity to completely destroy your enemies, and I'm talking about sin, the enemies that we face, whether it's our flesh, or whether it's the world, or whether it's the devil, you deal with it with complete ruthlessness. You don't let your enemies live. You don't defeat them and then allow them to continue. You take the enemies that come against you in your life and you completely destroy them so that you don't have to deal with them again. Now, interestingly, in 1 Samuel 31, Saul's going to see the Philistines again. Because Saul didn't kill the Philistines right here, he actually, ironically, ends up coming back and dying in a battle against the Philistines. There's an amazing picture for us there of sin. When we don't kill or destroy completely the sin that's in our lives, it comes back and inevitably many times it kills us. Let me tell you a story real quick about what the Eskimos do in dealing with wolves. It's graphic. I hope this doesn't offend anyone, but I hope it sticks with us. Sometimes sin should be described as graphically as the Bible describes it, because God wants us to have that kind of appreciation for it. So when Eskimos want to kill wolves, this is what they do. They take knives, they bury them upside down in the ice, with the blade sticking up and the handle in the ice. And then they take blood, and they pour the blood around the knife on the ice. And the wolves come up to the knife, and they start to lick it. And when they lick the knife, it lacerates their tongues. And then their tongues begin to put out blood that just spills all over the ground. And as that blood gushes out and spills all over the ice, the wolves just continue to lick and lap up that blood until finally what happens? It kills them. They go out the next day, and they see that wolf laying there on the ice right next to that knife. That's a picture of sin, that when we engage in it and we don't get away from it, inevitably there reaches that point where we continue to consume it until it kills us. And that's what transpired with Saul. He just couldn't get away from the knife, you might say. There's just been friends I've had in my life and we've talked, and I've heard him say, "I can't get away from the knife. I can't get away from the knife," after hearing that analogy. And inevitably, it's ruined some of their lives. They're not walking with the Lord, and it's terribly tragic. And the idea is that Saul is a guy who just couldn't get away from the knife. He's someone who couldn't stop licking the knife, you might say. He would never get the sin. He knew at that moment, when he stood there with Jonathan, he could have said, "I'm wrong. I'm wrong." But he couldn't bring himself to that kind of humility. The Philistines lived. They could have been destroyed this day, and they came back and they killed him. Now, verse 47, after Saul, and I'm going to read through these verses kind of quickly. After Saul had assumed rule over Israel, he fought against their enemies on every side. This is more of a summary of Saul's reign and not this chapter or even future events. Moab, the Ammonites, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment on them. He fought valiantly, and he defeated the Amalekites, delivering Israel from the hands of those who had plundered them. This is the battle with the Amalekites that we'll be reading next week. Saul's sons were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchishua. The name of his older daughter was Merab, and that of the younger was Michael. His wife's name was Ahinoam, daughter of Ahimaaz. The name of the commander of Saul's army was Abner, the son of Ner, and Ner was Saul's uncle. Saul's father Kish and Abner's father Ner were sons of Abiel. Now this is going to be important later when we're introduced to these people, but don't worry about it because I'm going to explain it all to you, okay? You're going to wonder, Abner, Ner, who are these different people, and what's their position in relationship to Saul? When we get to them, they're going to be important through the rest of 1 and 2 Samuel. I'll explain them. Verse 52, this is the important part. All the days of Saul there was bitter war with the Philistines. Whenever Saul saw a mighty or brave man, he took him into his service. Look at that last verse. Because of Saul's failure to be completely obedient to the Lord, because he stepped out in his partial obedience, he ended up having to contend with the Philistines the rest of his life. For the rest of Saul's reign, for the rest of his time as king, he had to deal with and fight with the Philistines because he didn't completely destroy them here. Now, look back in verse 37. When Saul tried to inquire of God here, God wouldn't answer him. It says, God wouldn't answer him. This isn't the only time we see that happening. In chapter 28, Saul tried to inquire of God, and the exact same thing is said. It says, Saul inquired of God, and God would not answer him. It's right before, when God wouldn't answer him, he went to visit the witch at Endor. He went to visit a medium and consult with the dead. He didn't get to hear from God, and so he went to a witch or a medium to try to hear from Samuel, who had died at this time. So both of these times, when Saul tried to inquire of God and God wouldn't answer him, God wouldn't answer him. And it really begs the question, why is that? Why is it that God wouldn't answer him and provide him with the wisdom that could have allowed him to live a life absent of the foolishness that was so evident? And I think the answer is back in verse 35. If you look at verse 35, it says, "Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first time he had done this." Because Saul had never constructed an altar before, representing the fact that he didn't have a close relationship with God, God wouldn't answer him when he inquired of God. Because Saul didn't have a close walk with God, because he didn't have an intimate relationship with him, he wasn't imparted with any of the wisdom that comes from knowing and walking with God. Now, in contrast to Saul, there's someone who inquired of God regularly, and every single time he inquired of God, God answered him. Just listen to these verses and the number of times that it says this person inquired of God. In 1 Samuel 23:2, it says this is David. David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go and attack these Philistines?" The Lord answered him, "Go, attack the Philistines and save Keilah." 1 Samuel 23:4. Once again, David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered him, "Go down to Keilah, for I'm going to give the Philistines into your hand." 1 Samuel 30, verse 8, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I pursue this raiding party? Will I overtake them?" "Pursue them," he answered, "you will certainly overtake them and succeed in the rescue." 2 Samuel 2, verse 1, David inquired of the Lord. 2 Samuel 5, 19, David inquired of the Lord. 2 Samuel 2, 21, verse 1, during the reign of David, there was a famine for three successive years, so David inquired of the Lord. And every single time that David inquired of the Lord answered him. I don't want you to miss the contrast that exists here between Saul and David, because Saul was this unspiritual man, never constructing an altar. God never answered him. David, being this man who had such a great heart and deep love for the Lord, every single time he inquired of the Lord, God answered him. James 1:5 says that if anyone lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. David is a perfect picture, one of the best pictures in the entire Bible, of someone who regularly asked God for wisdom, inquired of the Lord, and God always gave him that wisdom to make the necessary choices. Now, over the next few weeks, you know, we're going to see David encounter so many difficult situations. God was always there to direct him and guide him through all these sorts of twists and turns, you might say. Now, Saul, on the other hand, I don't want us to miss this. Saul's foolishness that we see in this chapter and that we saw in the previous chapter is going to continue to pervade all of Saul's life to the point where he's going to become a madman. It's going to fill him with an insanity and a paranoia that would be an amazing case study for any psychiatrist. I mean, Saul is one of the best pictures in the entire Bible of what the consequences of sin looks. I'm telling you, if you took Saul to any psychiatrist or psychologist and they tested him, they would have any number of different recommendations and diagnoses. He's got an overactive gland, he's got some emotional issues, and you give him this hormone, and his dad didn't treat him well enough, and if we just look at this, and it was none of those things. All the insanity and the foolishness that we see in Saul's life, it wasn't the result or consequence of any condition. It wasn't the result or consequence of any way that he had been treated. It was just the result of the sin and the lack of repentance that had invaded his life. Because of that, Saul was a man whose life was just characterized by tremendous foolishness. He stands as a great contrast to Saul. My prayer this week for myself, and my prayer for all of you, literally, was that we could have the kind of wisdom that's exemplified in David's life. That we wouldn't be like Saul. Do I attack? No, let's pray. Okay, no, pray when I should attack. Oh, swear an oath. Call for a fast. Look spiritual when I shouldn't. I'm not really sure. This is what my son did. Is it right? Is it wrong? I don't know. How's the priest calling for the Urim and Thummim? No, take your hand away. This is what we should do instead. Never really knowing exactly what's right. Never really understanding what would be the wise thing to do in any sort of circumstance. As opposed to him, our desire should be to look like David, where we can inquire the Lord and say, "Lord, this is the situation that I'm facing in my life. I've encountered this turn, or I've encountered this twist. I don't know exactly what to do right now. Will you direct me? Will you guide me? Will you impart me with some wisdom?" Like James 1:5 says, that will allow me to handle this situation correctly and biblically in a manner that would be pleasing to you. Now, so James is going to come up and he's going to play the last hymn. But I just want to ask you to stay seated a little bit because we have a few new members that I need to introduce following this hymn. Go ahead and join me in prayer, please. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for the examples of foolishness that are in Saul's life so that hopefully we can learn from him and not make these kind of mistakes ourselves, and more importantly, not have lives that are characterized by foolishness. And I thank you for David. I thank you that he was this man who could pray to you repeatedly, inquiring of you, and you would always answer him. And that we could see him as a premier example of what we can have in our lives as we seek wisdom and guidance and direction from you, Lord. So thank you for this time. We pray these things in Jesus' name.